Hello and welcome to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the unceded homelands of the Mohican people who are known today as the Stockbridge Muncie community. I'm Sina Bazila-Hickey.
And I'm Kathy Silber. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we begin with the legislative advocacy unveiled at the 40th birthday party for New York's bottle bill, brought to us by Mark Dunley. Then roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry talks with Albany's brother Minister X about his impressions of Malcolm X on what would have been his 97th birthday. Later on, Sina Bazila-Hickey talks with Dee Collin, artist in residence at the Fish Market in Troy. After that, Bria Barthel visits the open house of the Vegetable Project at Albany's Myers Middle and High Schools. And finally, in our weekly check-in with the community group, Deborah Garrett and Carolyn Hopkins Lewis join us to talk about Shades of Cocoa. But first, here are the headlines.
Albany County Sheriff Craig Apple is planning to run for the new 43rd State Senate District. The proposed new 43rd District includes Colony, where Apple lives, all of Rensselaer County, and part of Washington County.
New York is starting a statewide year-round program for collecting old paint to divert it from landfills. See paintcare.org for drop-off locations, most of which are paint or hardware stores.
The City of Troy's Planning Commission unanimously approved Hoboken Brownstone Co.'s $64 million proposal to convert an old city hall site at Monument Square into apartments, offices, stores, and a public square. Over the last decade, four previous efforts to develop this site have failed.
The Times Union reports that an animal civil rights group told New York's highest court Wednesday that Happy, a 51-year-old elephant at the Bronx Zoo, should be released into a spacious sanctuary based on ancient common law and the elephant's right to bodily liberty. The Wildlife Conservation Society, which runs the zoo, said that state laws designed to protect elephants have made it clear that they do not have the legal rights of a person. The animal rights advocates argued that Happy is an intelligent animal. Elephants have shown the ability to memorize thousands of words, hold 45-minute communications with one another, and mourn deaths.
Ulster County Executive Pat Ryan said he will be running in the August special election to fill the congressional seat being vacated by U.S. Representative Antonio Delgado, who is poised to become the next lieutenant governor of New York. However, the timing of the election is unclear since Delgado has not yet officially resigned.
Troy City Council President Carmela Mantello has introduced legislation amending the law in the city's code that states no person shall play ball in any of the streets of the city. The legislation will be voted on Thursday evening. And that's it for the headlines.
For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. Do you like what you hear? You can find all these stories and more at mediasanctuary.org/stories.
To learn how you can contribute, go to mediasanctuary.org, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org, or call 518-272-2390.
Advocates gather at the state capitol on May 18th to observe the 40th anniversary of the bottle bill, to urge lawmakers to increase the deposit to 10 cents and to expand it to include other containers such as wine, liquor, and non-carbonated beverages.
On the 40th anniversary of New York's bottle bill, environmental advocates and lawmakers gathered outside the state capitol on May 18th to celebrate with the birthday cake and called on state lawmakers to pass an improved and expanded bottle bill. We hear first from Ryan Carson of NYPIRG, who coordinates the Bottle Bill Coalition. We then hear from the lead legislative sponsors, Assemblymember Steve Englebright and Senator Rachel May. We finish with Judith Enck, who led the fight to pass the initial bottle bill and is now head of Beyond Plastics, and Martin Narrow, president of the Empire State Redemption Association.
Today, we are here to have a 40th birthday party for the bottle bill. Yeah. So, You know, a lot of people say, you know, turning 40 may be over the hill, but really, really, we are actually just getting started here at the Bottle Bill. But one thing that we are over is landfills, and that is what this bill is all about, and we're going to be increasing New York's recycling rate. So, 40 years of this bill, it has been unbelievably impactful. This is the premier piece of recycling legislation in New York State. It has reduced roadside litter by 70%. It has doubled New York's recycling rate, and it has drastically, drastically improved the lives of some of New York's most underserved communities. So when we're talking about the Bottle Bill, we're talking about a major, major expansion that is going to be taking effect very, very soon, and we only have 15 days to get this bill done. So when we're talking about the Bottle Bill expansion, we're really talking about two key things. The first thing with the Bottle Bill expansion is we need to add more containers into the Bottle Bill. Right now, it doesn't really make very much sense how we actually categorize what is covered and what is not. For example, so right here, I have a bottle of Coca-Cola. We're all very familiar with this. This is carbonated, so it's covered by the Bottle Bill. It's a soda, so this has a 5-cent deposit on it. Manufactured by the same company, like a Pure Leaf tea. This is not covered by the Bottle Bill. Why is it not covered by the Bottle Bill, you might ask? It's made out of PET plastic, it's just as recyclable. You know, it would make a lot of sense if both of these things, made by the same company, made from the same material, were to be recycled under the Bottle Bill. However, because this is uncarbonated, it is not covered by the Bottle Bill. So, when we have a more effective Bottle Bill that includes all types of plastics for all types of beverages, we're going to be able to recycle more plastic. We're going to be able to have a much higher redemption rate. Here in New York, we've really leveled off in bottle redemption rates in New York State. Right now, we are sitting at 64% bottle return rate. Whereas states that have a higher deposit rate, that have a 10-cent deposit rate, sit in the low 80s and high 90s, states like Oregon and Michigan. So the other key part of the Bottle Bill expansion is moving the deposit from 5 cents to 10 cents. Now, this is great for the consumer as well. Right now in New York State, municipal recycling is really struggling with the amount of plastic and glass that they have to handle every single day. Now, we need to divert more and more of that away to redemption centers. Now, we're going to get to hear from the Empire State Redemption Center Association in a couple of minutes that can talk about why it is so important that these go to redemption centers where they're much, much more likely to be recycled. But for the key issues for this Bottle Bill expansion, we are talking about expanding to types of glass that are not covered right now, which is liquor bottles, wine bottles, and hard cider bottles, and then the rest of plastics like this that need to be recycled and will be recycled in greater numbers because of this bill. Assemblymember Engelbreit, who is the key sponsor in the assembly.
At 40, it's time to look and see if we can improve what is clearly the most effective recycling program in the state's history. If we can do better, we should. And I believe that increasing the incentive for returning bottles and expanding the universe of bottles that are covered by the law is altogether appropriate.
I would like to call up our Senate sponsor, Senator May.
40 is a great age for a makeover. And here we go. So before I held elective office, I served on the board of the Onondaga County Resource Recovery Agency, which is one of the premier waste management agencies in the country, especially when it comes to their recycling and composting programs. And I was on the board as the recycling business went from something that was self-sustaining to something that was definitely not, where that you just couldn't find markets for recyclables, and municipalities and taxpayers were paying more and more and more to make recycling work. The Bottle Bill is a way both to increase recycling in returnables, but also to infuse that whole system with more funding. So it is a win for the environment, it is a win for municipalities and taxpayers, it is a win for consumers just across the board. One of the first bills I sponsored was to include cider bottles in the bottle bill because, you know, there's a lot of things we drink now that we didn't drink 40 years ago. But I think this bottle bill is going to make things much more clear and understandable. One of the biggest barriers to recycling and smart waste management is confusion. If you're just confusing the consumer, they're not going to participate. So this makes it simple, easy, and smart and sensible. And so I am very proud to sponsor the bill in the Senate and look forward to getting it through our the whole system and onto the governor's desk as soon as possible. Thank you.
So next up, I want to bring up Judith Enck, who is the president of Beyond Plastics, which is fighting to end our reliance on single-use plastics.
And thank you, Governor Kerry, wherever you are. It was his most, I think, significant environmental accomplishment. Billions of containers have been recycled. We have much less roadside litter. When we first passed the bill, we thought the nickel deposit would be used for kids who wanted to supplement their allowances. Little did we know that picking up bottles and cans would be a major source of income for so many of our brothers and sisters in the state who are struggling economically. And thankfully, the redemption centers who are here today make it easier for people. There are 10,000 people in New York City collecting bottles and cans at no cost to taxpayers. So we were able to add bottled water during David Patterson's administration. Thank you, former Governor Patterson and his stellar staff. And now we need to take the next step and expand as Ryan described. I know there's just a few weeks left to the legislative session, but who could possibly be opposed to this?
So next up, I want to call up Martin Nero from the Empire State Redemption Association, who will talk about the critical role that redemption centers play in the recycling process here in New York State.
And I have a dream that we will live in a more sustainable future, that we will help the circular economy thrive. I'm here today representing the Empire State Redemption Association, which has over 126 members across New York State. I am the proud founder and president of EvTech, which is a recycling technology company. It's that the science is clear that container return systems are the most effective recycling systems across the world, especially here in the United States. It is no secret that the U.S. struggles with a terrible 5% recycling rate when it comes to municipal and curbside recycling. However, container return systems boasted last year in New York State a 64% return rate for bottles and cans. And it is a fact that 85% of all recycled material that goes into packaging comes from redemption systems. As humankind stares an all-time high plastic crisis in the face, I applaud our senators, assembly members, and government representatives for supporting such a fine piece of legislation that will truly help us lead a more sustainable life. I also must give thanks to many of the unnoticed redemption centers, which are truly the backbone of the recycling industry here across New York State. Redemption centers buy thousands of containers at a time, are perhaps the most convenient way to return bottles and cans, allowing you to return thousands within a given minute.
This has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
We heard there from Ryan Carson of NYPIRG, Judith Enck of Beyond Plastics, Assemblymember Engelbright, Senator May, and the Redemption Association.
And next up, May 19th is the birthday of Brother Malcolm X. He'd be 97 today, but he was assassinated on February 21st, 1965, at age 39, as he addressed his Organization of Afro-American Unity at the Audubon Ballroom in Washington Heights. Roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry talks with Albany's Brother Minister X about his impressions of Malcolm X.
This is Willie Terry, the Roman labor correspondent for the Hudson Mohawk Network. You know, on Thursday, May the 19th, is the birthday of Malcolm X. And I have as my guest today, Brother Minister X, who will give me some information about Brother Malcolm. So how you doing, Brother X?
I'm doing well, brother. How you doing?
All right, all right. So just tell me a little bit about yourself, Minister X.
I've been, I can say, going to the Black Liberation Struggle the last 7 years. 8 years, I want to say, since 2014, the Frank Brown assassination in out there in Missouri. And that kind of spawned me to develop a relationship with my people, to study, to understand, to read. And that kind of galvanized me to get freedom for our people, realizing that someone could be murdered like that in the way that they were murdered. And, you know, I just wanted to know more. And so I probably start from there. In my previous life, even though I had children and had a college education and been an athlete, it felt like it was farcical, you know, that it didn't matter because I wasn't doing anything to better the life of Black people. So, you know, I joined an organization and led it. We did some very good things over the last 5 or 6 years for our people in the Capital District area. Met some great people, including yourself, brother. And so now it's 2022 and we're still struggling. Mm-hmm.
In the movement, there was a lot of people that got assassinated or killed. So how did it come that you took the name of, you know, the X on your name from Malcolm? How did you get involved with that?
Well, it's interesting you ask this question. I've been asked one other time. Mm-hmm. Malcolm had two reasons why he did it. One was he kept the X even though he had an official name given to him by the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad of Shabazz. But he was asked about the X, and he said, the reason why I keep it is two reasons. One, when you ask, I can go through history, I can give a history lesson, meaning X replaces the names that we have now. Those are Johnson's and Smith's and Warden and so on and so forth. These names are the names of our white slave masters. The names that we had before European contact, we don't know. They're lost forever. And so, you know, that's part of history that a lot of people don't know, especially Black. And he also said he would keep the X for as long as that, you know, the conditions that exist produced it. And so as long as those conditions persisted and continued, he would continue to go by Malcolm X. So until we were free, he wouldn't recognize his original name given to him.
Well, you know, we don't hear a lot about Malcolm X commemoration and celebration in the Albany area or the Capital District area as compared to Dr. King. So why do you think that is? What's the reason of that?
Well, one of the major reasons was Dr. King was taken by the dominant society. Dr. King's past and his history is pretty deep, and the state that controls everything, controlling apparatus, controls history. When you go to the victor goes to spoils. So once I defeat you, I control not only my history, but your history. And I can make it so that you won't know information unless I give it to you. And that goes along with Dr. King. And so because he led a nonviolent struggle, he is somebody the state can use against Black people. Mm-hmm. And there are many of videos where he is saying, listen, yeah, this is a nonviolent struggle. If you can't struggle nonviolently, don't get into it. Love your enemy. So take these beatings, take these whippings, and continue to love them. And maybe they'll allow you a seat at the table, even though you have your own table and your own restaurants and your own homes and so on and so forth. We would like to be with you. And so that's a controlling apparatus. That's saying, I don't want to have control over my destiny or have certain self-determination. I want you to control things for me. I want you to control my life, and I'm fine with whatever decisions that you make, even if it means sacrifices, African lives to be taken because of the white power structure produces white men who decide on a whim to kill Black men for whatever reason. And so with that being said, they placed King above everybody else. And so money goes into the history of Dr. King, which they want us to know. People don't know he had gun storages. People don't know he had brothers with guns surveilling his home and protecting his family because his house got burned down so many times. People don't know that he was okay with the radical movement on the out and the periphery of his marches to make sure that they're protected. But they also don't know that he had connections with, I believe, the Rothschilds and so on and so forth, that he had access to American presidents. And most activists don't have that type of they don't have that type of connection. They don't have those type of resources where you have the head of state that you can call and get you out of jail, you know. So that's not necessarily good for us, but it's great for them to take him and put money into him and put money into his way of struggle. Hey, if black people, if you feel a particular way of how we're treating you, you could take the doctrine of Dr. King, right? And maybe we'll make things better, but that's the way we'd like for you to struggle, right? We will put a rubber stamp on that. Minister Malcolm gets no resources because they know his history and they know he meant self-defense. And it was about defending ourselves against violent racist attacks, which are continuing to this day. And he talked about going to war with the Ku Klux Klan. He said, hey, if you are a white liberal, because he was strategic, white liberals who consider themselves friends or allies of the struggle of black people, you should even feel okay with an extremist group and us defending ourselves against an extremist group. That too, even though he said white liberals are the worst type of liberal there was, or white person there was, because he's fake. You know, he wants you, he smiles in your face, but he wants to keep you in the position that you're in, the inferior position that you're in. He said, you know, get guns. He told brothers, start rifle clubs. You know, he told brothers, you know, I'm going to Africa and I'm going to meet with African presidents and African kings, people who have control and power. And I forget the name of the individual, but he was told, hey, I have guns for you if you got soldiers. I got guns. You have to get your own soldiers. And he brought that back to his organization. And you know, these are run-of-the-mill 9-to-5 brothers and sisters who want to do things better for the community. But he had the connections to revolutionary groups that he couldn't be connected to publicly. But behind the scenes, he was. And the state knew that. The state knew that he had connections to them. The state knew that he knew the leaders of these organizations and stuff. If you check Mike Wallace's interview with Malcolm X, Mike Wallace was trying to push him to admit his connection with him because he had inside information that he did. But Malcolm, being the on-code and the genius man that he was, kept pushing it to the conditions. The conditions are the reason why these groups exist. White men should not ever get comfortable in thinking that black men are willing to live in this manner for the rest of their lives or for generations. That there are a small faction who don't care about death. You know, they want to free their people and they will strike. And so if you don't change things, they'll change those things for you. That wasn't the tongue of Dr. King. So they kept him at 63, the March on Washington, which was contrived and controlled and dominated by the Kennedy administration, got hold of it, got King and put King in front of it. And now he's the hero. And it was them that came up with it. No, it was brothers and sisters in Detroit, Chicago, in New York on the ground who said they were going to go to D.C. and let the chips fall where they may. They were going to stop airlines from coming down. They were going to stop all traffic. That was revolution. And so they had to get in front of it and put King in front of it. And so that's the story they're going to tell. They're not going to tell Malcolm's story because Malcolm got the information and told it immediately. I mean immediately, his next address. So King is always going to be their push man. And they're going to put him out front. I talk to children all the time. They know who King is. Don't hear anything about Malcolm X. And that's done deliberately.
You can find a wealth of stories about Malcolm X on our website.
For those of you just tuning in, I'm Sina Bazila Hickey.
And I'm Kathy Silber. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network on WOOCLP 105.3 FM Troy. WOOSLP 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOALP 106.9 FM Albany, WOOGLP 92.7 FM Troy, and WCAALP 107.3 FM Albany. This program comes from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the unceded homelands of the Mohican people, known today as the Stockbridge-Munsee community.
This program covers stories of social and environmental justice produced by the community for the community and is supported by independent donations. To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
Dee Collin is the current artist in residence at the Fish Market, a repurposed location in North Troy that serves as a space for arts and community engagement. Sina Bazilahicki visited Dee in her space to talk about painting, writing, and community engagement.
This woman that I'm painting is standing in front of what will be a cascade of flowers. Of violets and some other bunches of flowers. I want it to look like she's descending from the clouds, but there aren't any clouds. It's all flowers. And she's holding a head of herself that's, it's holding the emotions that are ready for anything, ready for the world. She is comfortable in holding space for her anger, for her rage, and using that as a catalyst for change. And there's a brick wall, but the brick wall looks like just like bright sunlight.
My name is Dee Collin, and I'm a multidisciplinary artist, but I mostly work in poetry, visual art, and theater and performance.
So we're standing in the Fish Market. You are the current artist in residence. Mm-hmm. We're looking at one of the paintings that's on this propped up wall. The painting is 6 feet tall, I would assume?
I have no idea how big this is. I just know that it's big.
As you were describing this woman that is in process, this painting, as somebody who is pretty well known to be an activist artist in the scene, I definitely heard you describing yourself. How much of your own self, we're surrounded by paintings, how much of self-portraiture is a part of your work?
Well, my first self-portrait is hanging on the wall. That piece has been in a couple places. One in a show called Womanist that I collaborated with Keon Hennessy with. And it was also hanging at the Art Center of the Capital Region for the Fence show. And now it's here at the Fish Market, and it's the first self-portrait that I've ever done. And now I'm just exploring more self-portraits. It's like an exercise in self-healing, self-identity, exploration. I'm a really big fan of Frida Kahlo. And I was really thinking about why Frida painted so many self-portraits. And I thought to myself, I should try. So I painted one and I was like, oh, now I understand, Frida. It really makes you dig deep into yourself. And there's something very intimate about looking at yourself while you're painting yourself. It's so much longer a period of time than looking at yourself in a mirror. And I think it just makes you think about a lot of different things and self-reflect in a really deep way.
Through this process of self-portraiture, what are some of the things that you've realized about yourself? Some things that you've just been able to articulate about who you are a little better?
Well, the series that I'm painting now is all about healing and recovery. I think that, you know, a lot of us are healing from a lot of different things. The last couple years alone, it's just There's been a lot in the last few years that we are still kind of recovering from. And so I'm thinking of healing in that way, but I'm also thinking of things that I've been healing from over time and I want to release and let go of. And when this year started, I always choose a word at the beginning of the year, and my word this year was transformation, and I added resolute in front of that. So it's resolute transformation, and what that means for me.
So what's great about these open days at the fish market is visitors can come and see the progression of the work that you're doing. Could you talk about what the experience has been like for you and what this space has allowed you to do?
It's been cool to see people come in and see the work and interact with the work, especially works that are in progress, and just hearing feedback and seeing, like, hearing what they see, because I see something, but it's interesting to hear other people talk about what they also see. I have had a few folks come in looking for fish. We don't have any fish at the fish market. It's art and poetry. And I've been hosting open mic, and the poetry in the space has been awesome. And having folks share poems. But for the open hours, those 2 days of time where the public can just come in and either create with me or have a conversation, we've sketched together, we've painted together. There was the banner for the Norlite rally. We did that during open hours. We've also had people outside with the chalk, and so that's been great, you know, having people draw on the sidewalks. Today I had a mom and her 2 kids knock on the door, even though the open hours aren't today. And so I went to the door and she asked for chalk, and I gave her and her kids some chalk, and they just drew on the sidewalk. And that was really cool. So it's nice to see people responding to the work either outside or inside, or all the interactions between events or art that we're creating together, or sharing space with poetry, whatever the thing is. It's just really nice to see community interacting with the art and with each other.
When I spoke with Meg Jala, I think the neighborhood wasn't quite used to an art space here yet, and it sounds like it has progressed. Why is this important to have an art space here at this location?
For exactly what you just said, you know, if people aren't used to seeing art, especially this accessible in their community, then it should be there. You know, I think we should just have more art everywhere. To be honest, it's a way for people to release. It's a way for people to heal. It's a way for people to connect. It's a way for people to build community. It's also a way to inspire changes that we want to see in our community. Art just creates this dialogue that I think is just important to so many different neighborhoods, you know? And so the more of it we have wherever is really, really important. And I'm really happy that it's in this neighborhood in particular.
In addition to being a painter, you're a multifaceted artist. You're working on some things. How can people be a part of your experience through workshops and visiting hours?
So I teach workshops. Sometimes I teach workshops in person at a particular venue, but I also teach things online, which means that people can register for my workshops from wherever they are located, wherever. That's really cool. That's something that I kind of got over the course of the pandemic, was transitioning from only having in-person workshops to now offering things online. And I think that's been helpful for folks. I've helped some people who live in other states because I'm offering things online. I have this program that's coming up that I'm starting in June called Striving Artist. And I'm really excited about that because I've over the course of my years being a full-time artist, I've had people ask me questions, you know, about how I do things, how they can also make it as an artist, how do they make it as a poet, and, you know, all the things from marketing to monetizing to, you know, just pricing your work or, you know, getting your work out there, the submission process, all kinds of questions. And so I put together a program called Striving Artist, because we're not starving. And it's just really me. I'm going to be sharing like all of my gems, you know, everything that I've learned about doing what it is that I do full time. And that's on my website, dcolin.com. I think all of my work is grounded in like, what can I contribute through my art, and how can I inspire people to do something different, or inspire something that will benefit us all.
Thank you so much for speaking with me, dColin, for Hudson Mohawk Magazine. dColin has another 2 months in her artist residency at the Fish Market. A great way to keep up to the going-ons is to follow Fish Market Project on Instagram. You can drop by and say hi during the community hours on Tuesdays and Saturdays. And coming up, there's a poetic vibe night on the next two Mondays, a special one on Memorial Day.
The Vegetable Project, which involves students at Albany's Myers Middle School and High School in growing and eating new types of food, held an open house on May 5th. Let's drop in.
Hi, this is Bria Barthel for Hudson Mohawk Magazine, and today I'm delighted to be at Stephen and Harriet Myers Middle School in Albany, where the Vegetable Project is having a wonderful event. I'm talking with Kiki, one of the volunteers for the Vegetable Project, who will introduce us to the project, the event, and the importance of teaching kids how to garden. Kiki?
Hi, my name is Kiki Soto, also known as Urban Girl Gardening, and I am a volunteer with the Vegetable Project here in Albany. And what we do is we go to the schools and we help children learn to grow. We help them from seed to harvest, and they come out, they taste what they grew, they have a lot of hands-on experience, and it's super important for kids to know where their food comes from, to be involved in the growing process, and they'll be more likely to make healthy decisions.
Tell us about the event.
Oh my gosh, Evening in the Garden. It's a beautiful event. And you look around, there's lots of people eating with our wonderful vendors here. And in the garden that we have behind us, you can see everything that the kids have started growing already. And yeah, it's a lovely evening.
I was talking with a sixth grader, Serenity, who said it was her first year here, and she was thrilled to show me the vegetables that she planted and the flowers that she planted. Mm-hmm. What kind of response do you get from the kids that are involved?
Oh my goodness. You know, when we first started volunteering with the kids, I was a little shocked because usually children who are excited about growing usually start growing at home. A lot of the kids that we got involved weren't used to throwing seeds in the dirt and getting their hands dirty, but they were so excited. They were so excited to, maybe it was just because they were getting out of class, but they were excited to be getting started and to know that where their food comes from, they'll have a little part in it. You know, they'll come back and harvest at the beginning of the school year, and they can know that they had a hand in it. So they were very excited. What we're trying to do is at least get the kids interested in knowing where their food comes from and knowing how to grow their own food and how simple it is. And maybe even take the idea back home to their parents who don't know that sometimes they can just grow something in the window, you know, or on their balcony or porch or something like that.
You said your website is The Urban Girl Gardening?
T-H-E-E, The Urban Girl Gardening. I have a YouTube channel, actually. I teach people how to grow food in their basements, their windows, their garages, and in their backyards. So my thing is, any space that you have, you can grow something. As a matter of fact, on my channel, I will be harvesting lettuce and radishes from my window garden. Yes, my front window garden in my living room, right behind the sofa where we sit and watch television, I got some food growing. So if I can do it, anybody can do it anywhere.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for your work. And anything that encourages kids to connect with nature and with healthy food is terrific. So thanks a lot. I'm now talking with Kiki's child.
Hello, I'm AJ. I'm a very good gardener.
What's your favorite thing to grow?
Dino kale.
dino kale. Is it made from real dinosaurs?
I think so. I think that's why it's called dino kale.
And what does dino kale look like?
It looks like normal kale, but a little more detailed.
He's right.
Okay, we just got confirmation from Kiki that he's right. What else do you like to grow?
Tell about the strawberries?
Yes, I like to do the strawberries.
Thanks a lot. Good talking with you, AJ. And to find out more about the Vegetable Project, I'm now talking with the president of the nonprofit organization. Can you tell us your name and a little bit about what you do?
My name is Bill Stoneman. I sometimes would prefer a title like Chief Weed Puller. This is my baby. We have been working in Albany schools, and particularly at this school, for nearly 13 years. We are, at our core, parents of kids who go to Albany schools or did go to Albany schools. I have an adult daughter who went to middle school in this building, Myers Middle School, and we are acutely aware that many, many kids in Albany schools are not thriving. They tend to have challenging lives, difficult lives. They're, it can be measured in socioeconomic terms, like in stressed families, in difficulty of all kind, that impedes their academic progress, their social progress, their life progress. And we think that the school world that is very focused on a very specific curricular regime is not always meeting these kids' emotional needs and psychological needs that have to come before they can do algebra. And gardening is just one phenomenal tool to get kids touching things and experimenting and trying things and out of their routine. And that's what we're about.
Now, you said that you've been involved from the start 13 years ago. So in that time, you must have seen kids that were involved with the program for a few years. Did you see changes in their behaviors or their sense of themselves?
So unfortunately, that's not as much success as I would wish. Although I saw one kid here tonight, 20-year-old, who met him as a 12-year-old. He's a kid on the autism spectrum. And first time out here was just terrified of insects and anything flying around him. And I think we helped him make his peace with the surroundings. We tend to see kids for short periods of time. We don't have the continuity with kids that we would like to. Part of the reason we're holding an event like an open house that we have tonight is to share with more people what we're doing, which we hope is a step toward building more resources to do more what we would like, stick with kids longer.
And we're here at Stephen and Harriet Myers Middle School. I understand you also have gardens at Albany High School?
We have a garden at Albany High School, and we work in the building on more of an ad hoc basis in other Albany City schools as we come up with particular projects. We would love to get to more schools. It's a matter of building the capacity to do so.
Well, thank you very much for your work, and thanks for taking a couple minutes to talk with me. So I'm here with another supporter of the Vegetable Project, and she works at a different garden in the Albany school system. So can you introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about what you do and why you do it?
Hi, my name is Amy Jasitis, and I work in the Friendship Garden associated with the Delaware Avenue School. And I do it because I love gardening, and it makes me so excited to see things grow. And I want to give that to kids. And it's also very empowering, the idea that you can plant something and watch it grow, and then, as in the Vegetable Project, you get to eat it. And the kids love that. They think it's so exciting. And it's an opportunity that many of them don't have at home. So it's a great thing for them to go and experience and feel empowered and try new foods.
And I know, truth be told, Amy and I are old friends, that you worked in Department of Public Health in nutrition education. Can you tell us a little bit about how you see this related to nutrition education?
Sure. A lot of kids don't get the exposure to a variety of vegetables at home because a lot of vegetables can be very expensive and people are strapped for time. So this gives them exposure to a lot of things that they might not otherwise try. And sometimes at home, kids don't want to try it because it's a vegetable, whatever. But if their friends are trying it, or if it's put in a new salsa that they've never had and they get to try it with chips, they're willing to try it, and it's expanded their palates. So it's a good way to learn about eating healthful food.
Now, when you work in the Friendship Garden, are you there on your own with other volunteers, or are you there actually side by side with kids?
Both. It's a number of kids from the school, and then there are anywhere from 6 to 10 volunteers on any given garden day.
And do you do events throughout the year, or is it mostly focused on the spring, or how does it work with the school year?
It's spring and fall. So it's a group of kids, about 20 kids, get selected, and they get to come every week for about 8 weeks, both in the spring and the fall.
Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
This is another volunteer with the Vegetable Project. Can you tell us your name and a little bit about why you're involved?
Absolutely. I'm Tamitra Rose. I am one of the board members for the Vegetable Project. And I got involved, I want to say, probably 4 years ago. I was an assistant principal at this very school, Myers Middle School. And once I knew there was a garden in the back, I just somehow met Bill, but expressed my interest in gardening for students. And as much as I could, I would bring students out in the back, if anything was growing, we would pull and taste, and the relationship grew from there. I'm no longer at the school, I'm at an elementary school, but because of the relationship I had with Bill, I agreed to join the Vegetable Project probably about 2 years ago, and I just love being a member. I love this event. I remember attending my very first event and was just really surprised by the amount of people that came out to support. And so as long as I'm working for Albany, I will continue to be a part of the Vegetable Project.
What do you find most fulfilling?
I think just being in the dirt, helping to pull weeds, I actually find that quite gratifying. I grew up in New York City, so I didn't know much about gardening, but when I had my own house and my own garden, I just loved being in the dirt and playing. Now that we have a connection to the schools, having children come out and getting their hands dirty where they may not have that opportunity at home to do so, that's also very fulfilling and gratifying for me.
Thank you very much.
Just heard it from a variety of voices on the Vegetable Project's recent open house. For more information, see vegetableproject.org.
And now it's that time in the show when we hear from a local community group. And today it's a pleasure to welcome the co-founders of Shades of Cocoa, Deborah Garrett and Carolyn Hopkins Lewis. Welcome to you both.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you. Deborah, you've been on the show several times, I know. And I think most recently was your interview with Willie Terry back in November at the Thanksgiving event at the Oakland Community Center. Is that right?
Yep. So on back in November, we hosted our first Cocoa's Given. And it started out to be a small event for just the Shades of Cocoa members, and it ended up growing. A lot of community members wanted to come out and support. And we ended up having about, I want to say maybe about 60 people, give or take. And it ended up being a really nice event. And it just was about allowing the girls to be able to sit down, family style, and just to share a meal together.
That's really great. I know that many of our listeners are quite familiar with Shades of Cocoa, but for those who aren't, I wonder if we could take a step back to the very beginning. If you could share the story of the founding of Shades of Cocoa, and was it the two of you? Carolyn, can you start it off? And Deborah, you can chime in.
I would like to start it off just because I want to, the reason being is because it came from just the idea of me just wanting to have something for my daughter, to be honest. I grew up as a only girl, so no siblings other than my, no sisters other than my brothers. And then I kind of brought it to Carolyn. She's also only child. And then I can't forget Sadasia, because Sadasia is also a part of the founding members and help bring this idea to life. Although she has a sister, she is the youngest of her siblings. So just wanting to have that connection to like the sisterhood. And mm-hmm. I can let Carolyn add more onto it.
And yes, I have a young preteen who is a only daughter. So we needed something to, as far as to give her some connection with other females positive, you know, like you said, a sisterhood.
Yeah, that idea of a sisterhood is so important. And now, Deborah, you said you grew up without sisters, and so you wanted your daughter is an only girl and wanting her to have that experience. So could I just ask you, you say you, Carolyn, you said you had a preteen. Could I check in on the ages of your girls?
She is 12, mm-hmm. and who thinks she's like 18, you know how that is.
Oh, yeah.
I just, you know. And I'm like, you know, like Deborah said, I am my only child. So, you know, dealing with females as far as our age gap is a whole new ball game for me. So I needed other individuals to help me in this process. Sure. Because what I did when I was 13 and what she's going through with her 13 is a whole new world.
It anticipates one of the questions I want to ask, but before we get, that's so important. Well, before we get there, Deborah, how old is your daughter?
My daughter actually just turned 8 on May 11th. It's the same thing. She, you know, she's 8, but she's like 28 in her head, you know? So.
So what I hear from both of you, I want to get into how their childhood, how their girlhood and how they're growing up. Well, let's just go right there. Why save the good stuff until later? We've all had our own experiences of girlhood, and I'm sure in every instance it was hell. I mean, it was hell for me. I don't know if it was pretty much hell for the rest of you, but let's say it isn't easy. It's never easy to grow from a girl into a woman, and I think especially when you're a girl of color. And so what was it that you experienced yourselves? You don't have to get into anything you don't want to get into, obviously, but then what new challenges are you seeing? Carolyn, you mentioned for your daughter, what she's going through is just like nothing you ever had to deal with.
So for me, it's social media.
Mm.
You know, so what is the etiquette part as far as social media? You know, what is right? What is wrong? How much do you allow? How much you do not allow? What is acceptable and what is not acceptable? It's just like saying it's a whole new world. It's like it's another planet.
Yeah.
A completely different planet, you know? So it's things that you want to say, okay, I'd rather deal with this than to deal with that. But what is this and what is that?
Yeah.
So you have to figure out what is your boundaries, you know, and to make them, you don't want to isolate them, but you don't want to give them too much freedom at the same time.
Right. So being part of an organization with other mothers of other daughters, and we're now about halfway through, we're going to run out of time before we know it, can give you some kind of benchmarks and something to compare, because all the girls are going to say, well, nobody else's mom makes them, you know, yada, yada, yada. And you're like, oh, well, I happened to check it. I know that's not true. Deborah, what about for you? Is it the same thing? Is it social media?
The social media to me is not that big of a deal. But
she's 8 because she's
right.
8.
But no, it's not even her age. It's more so my age, because I'm one of the kids that grew up with the AOL when that was like a thing with the dialing. So I came in that era, so I can kind of monitor it a little better.
Yeah.
I think for me, it's just the fact of having that conversation, making sure that I keep open dialogue. Mm-hmm. And what I do find with the ages is that my kids' friends' parents are much younger than I am. So I'm trying to find that balance and trying to, you know, you want to stay kind of connected to that generation. So that's what I'm finding. So, but the social media is not that doesn't faze me as much.
Yeah. Okay. I get that. I studied your website. I've looked at your Facebook page, and I have taken a look at your girl's vision. Self-care, self-image, empowerment, and development. And I read that if there's one goal that you consider more important than all the others is to engender a sense of self-love in girls of color. And that really resonates with me, just because I think a sense of self-love is really hard to come by for anyone, but I think especially growing up in America as a girl of color, it is no easy thing. And I think especially, Carolyn, you mentioned social media. Back in the day when the girls were just comparing themselves with each other relentlessly, Now they're not even comparing themselves with the reality of each other. They're comparing themselves with manufactured images of other girls. So, and there's so much about pride in oneself, and especially if you're a girl of color. I mean, color is your appearance, it's your skin. You're not going to want to duck around and hide from your beauty and hide from your proud, beautiful self. But on the other hand, so much of social media is putting your proud, beautiful self out there. How do you thread that needle?
Well, you know, when you have, I can say it quickly for myself, when you have a village who is teaching them to love themselves, and you constantly tell them to love themselves, they will love themselves, you know? So they cannot leave that part alone. They have to understand that.
Yeah.
And I think for me is more so of the, it's that, and then it's the education piece, right? So there's so much data related to confidence and how well women and boys, honestly, no matter what color you are, but predominantly we're speaking about young Black girls. It's data around the confidence level. If you're confident, you feel good about yourself, you're going to show up every day at 1,000, right? Versus if you don't feel good. And that's any woman, realistically, anybody, you know, when you got a new outfit on, you feel good sometimes, you know? So,
You know, this is such a rich conversation, and I have so many more thoughts and questions that I want to exchange with you. And we're almost out of time. And so I'm just going to have to practically insist that you come back so that we continue this conversation. If people want to get involved, I know you have an event coming up on June 17th for Juneteenth.
So we invite anyone to come and help support, and we're having a Coco's pageant. So we're putting a spin on a beauty pageant. So Shades of Cocoa presents a Cocoa pageant. And we're just basically saying, like, we define our beauty, right? So normally you go to pageants and there's a winner, and we're just saying, like, we define our beauty. We decide what is beautiful for us from the inside out. And we're just, like, promoting that for the girls. We're promoting that, letting them know that self-love is the most important love. And how they see themselves is more important than how somebody else sees them.
That is the message that everyone needs to hear. It's a great thing you guys are doing. You have a website, shadesofcoco.org. You have a Facebook page. I'd like to thank you for being on the show, and I look forward to having you both back.
Thank you. I have to make sure I mention that the Coco's pageant is going to be June 17th at 6 p.m. at Oakwood Community Center, 313 10th Street, Troy, New York. Kudos for Oakwood for being a backbone for us. And I would be not me if I didn't mention that.
No, you would have been remiss indeed. And it was my bad for not dragging that out of you. Thank goodness you were on the ball. Thank you again. Look forward to seeing you again soon.
Thank you so much, both of you.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye, guys.
And that concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Sina Bazilahicki.
And I'm Kathy Silber.
Our content is produced entirely by volunteers. To learn how you can contribute to local stories of social and environmental justice, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Thank you to all of our volunteers and Sanctuary Sustainers. If you value independent media, consider a gift of a monthly donation as a Sanctuary Sustainer by going to mediasanctuary.org.
Tune in every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to hear local news or stream Sanctuary Radio at mediasanctuary.org. Hudson Mohawk Magazine is also available on demand as a podcast on Facebook at Hudson Mohawk Magazine or as individual stories at mediasanctuary.org. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.